Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I am delighted to be having this conversation. You and I have gotten to know each other over about the last year. I don't know why we haven't had you on the podcast sooner. We had a long conversation. I think I remember sitting on my back porch here, sunny right in the middle of summer, maybe early spring or something. It seemed like we were thinking about getting you on here then. And for some reason, we dropped the ball on that one. So here we are in early 2021. The world has changed a little bit. I think the world was just as messy then as it is now. We probably have a little bit more clarity about where the world's going. But before we dive into our subject, Michael, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, thank you, Jason. It's really a privilege to be with you today and give yourself some grace there. It's been an interesting year and a lot going on for sure. But honored to be here. I'm Michael Ward, and I'm privileged to serve as the executive director of the North Carolina Textile Foundation at NC State University. I've been in higher education advancement for more than 20 years now, primarily in North Carolina. Spent a little bit of time in the Midwest, but my scope of work has included Division I athletics, state and plan giving, gift and estate planning. I'm sorry, it's been a while, and then academic major gift work, principal gift work, and now leading a team of six.
Michael, when you and I talked, you promised me a copy of some book. I think I promised you a copy of my book. I doubt I sent it. And I don't think you ever sent me the one you were supposed to send me. You were featured in some sort of publication. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was honored to be featured in Start With Heart by Bill Crouch. And it really talks about, what makes an effective gift officer and the importance of a high level of emotional intelligence and starting with heart. And I really subscribe to that, and I believe in that. I think when you're able to be who you are, that resonates with alumni and donors that you're working with. And, they want to have a genuine, authentic relationship with you. And I'm a big believer in emotional intelligence and the art of fundraising, more so than the science.
Yeah, I've gotten that impression in our conversations, Michael, and I certainly appreciate that about Bill. I've gotten to know him a little bit. Him and I last bumped into each other, I think it was in 2019 at the AFP's regional conference in the Lehigh Valley here in Pennsylvania. And we've got some mutual friends that have worked together as well. Michael, what are we going to talk about today?
Jason, there's a whole lot to talk about. I think I'll say that one of the reasons that I was captivated by you and some of your close associates throughout the U.S. is I subscribe to, you know, similar beliefs that you have. And I would love to talk, you know, more about, you know, why I think we've been successful. Relationships matter. Elevating relationships matter. When you're able to elevate relationships, you're going to elevate the impact of philanthropy. You're going to be to elevate the impact of your students and your mission. And so, you know, I think it's really important that, you know, for me, it's important that we in our profession really take a hard look at, you know, relationships versus, I would say, you know, performance standards, minimum performance standards or certain metrics to try to push through gifts that ultimately could be much larger exponentially if done the right way.
Yeah, Jennifer Harris reached out to me, I don't know, it was about probably 4 to 6 weeks ago. And Jennifer Harris, for those of her don't know, she's a good friend, mutual friend, Michael and I's. She's been a guest here on the podcast and works on the West Coast with a number of organizations around the country. But Michael, she reached out to me, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks ago. And she says, you know, that guy, Michael Ward at NC State. And I said, yeah, I think I do. Of course I do. Anyway, we put two and two together, but it sounds like you guys had a pretty meaningful conversation, probably something along the lines of what you and I have been talking about over the, you know, since you and I have been talking. And she's just part, I suspect, some of what was in that conversation that you and Jennifer had, as well as the conversations you and I have had. And I think the direction we can take this conversation is, I think we're talking about, Michael, sort of our current generation of sort of fundraising leadership, sort of coming into a time when we can be, we just cannot be as, it's one of the comments you made before we hit the record button. We can't be automatons. You know, we can't be formulaic. We've got to be real human beings. And I think if anything, the COVID-19 sort of reality has really, and I had a guest on here recently saying the same sort of thing. Look, the world has gotten pretty darn unpredictable. And if you think you're going to run a really well-oiled, efficient machine now, that's everything, all the output's going to be very predictable, good luck. I mean, isn't that sort of what you're thinking?
Absolutely, Jason. I think back to the onset of this pandemic, and I think what makes this one so different. We've had our tragedies with, national tragedies around terrorism with 9/11. We've had market crashes that impact philanthropy. And now I have this pandemic. And I think what makes this pandemic so unique is that we've been isolated from our donor base. We weren't isolated from our donor base during 9/11. We weren't isolated from our donor base during tough economic times. And what struck me was within a week, all the national big corporate consultants had all the answers. And how do you have all the answers to how you fundraise in a pandemic when we've never been through a pandemic?
And well, we've been through a pandemic, but it's been like 100 years ago.
it's been quite a while for sure. Yes.
Right. I mean, your reaction's the same as mine. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, you're telling these people how to navigate this thing. Right. I know exactly where you're at. And I saw those emails too. And I'm like, yeah, keep doing this and do it this way. And I'm like, man, when's the last time you actually navigated it? Something like
that. For sure. And if we really subscribe and believe in the moves of management, there is a cultivation and a stewardship element to that. And I think this is the opportunistic time for nonprofits to really be checking in with their donors that have given, see how they're doing, what can you do for them, focusing on that relationship. It's not all about us. It's about them as well. I believe that, you know, I have a young team. So when I started with the foundation, it was a team of two. We've grown. We've had a lot of great success. I'm proud to say that we've raised over $50 million in 5 years for the Wilson College Textiles. And, you know, one of the things that I drew attention to when I came in was, how are you going to develop a major gift pipeline when you're not focused on the base and you're not focused on, you know, your young alumni and you're not focused on programming? So we did a real pivot during COVID. Two of my officers have been with me less than 2 years. These are new positions. They've been, you know, they have discovery portfolios. It's 100% qualification. It's got to be the hardest part of any move is the qualification part. And on top of that, trying to qualify on a Zoom call or a phone call is difficult. So we've done a lot of themed virtual town halls with our dean, with our alumni, multicultural, diversity and inclusion, our Pioneer Scholars Program, our Centennial Program, socially unjust issues where we've been able to pull in a diverse alumni base that we've never been able to connect or resonate with. And we've made unbelievable connections with people internationally in states we would never travel to because it's they're self-identifying a level of interest. And, yeah. You know, it's not, I don't want them to necessarily spend 40 hours of the week, you know, dialing for dollars or trying to like do that discovery work. I want to create, you know, some unique opportunities and platforms that we'll continue to do when we come out of this pandemic to engage our alumni in a meaningful way at every level. And I'm proud to say that when you do look at the metrics, we do have the highest engagement score at the university, and we have well over 75 participants on each of these Zoom calls, and they are leading to more conversations about their charitable interest and re-engaging with the college. And you know, it's really a time for us to be investing back in our alumni and donor base more than anything.
There's been a couple of people not here on the podcast. Most of my podcast guests are a little more savvy on this sort of truth than I'd say some of the people who've asked me this. I've had a couple of clients sort of ask me this question, but they're sort of searching for, in the midst of COVID, they know that a platform like Zoom will work for them. And you and I right now, we're using a very similar platform. It's essentially facilitating this. It's essentially a channel through which you and I can communicate virtually. It's not a whole lot. You know, we've got to sort of get over the hump of the idea that we're not sitting at a coffee table, but for the most part, if we can sort of allow the technology to do its job. But I think there's a number of people here's my thought, Michael, and I'm interested in hearing your thoughts. I shared this with somebody else recently. I think in the midst of COVID and sort of the outcome of this is that some of the disparities that exist within the nonprofit sector between the organizations that are raising significant dollars and those that are not, sort of the traditional notion of haves and have nots, is actually going to widen. Because I think there's going to be a lot of organizations out there that they're going to think that in this era of social distancing, right, they're going to think that that's now the rationale to double down on the shallow, low context fundraising tactics that generally yield perhaps those initial gifts, sort of the you know, the Giving Tuesday stuff, the direct response stuff, the very automated stuff. But they're going to say, you know what, in this era of social distancing, we just can't engage in meaningful ways. And I think, the haves, the organizations that have perhaps sort of gotten on the other side of what I call arm's length fundraising, are very much aware that you're not going to raise significant dollars if you're not building meaningful relationships. And you're going to have to take the same skills that we learned across the lunch table and across the coffee table, and you're going to have to put them right here in this Zoom call or in this, you know, podcast conversation. Am I right?
I think you are right. I think, again, you know, if you want transformative giving, it is going to be investing your time in meaningful relationship work face to face. I think what you'll see with, you know, on the other end of that spectrum, which is good as well in some regards, is maybe some new tactics around crowdsourcing fundraising with a lot of what we're seeing. With the technologies, you know, we've had a lot of questions from alumni that are concerned about what's education going to look like. Is there going to be less classroom instruction? Because, you know, all the higher education's had a great opportunity to systematically build out online education, you know, in some regard. And I know at NC State, being a Research One institution and a STEM school, the answer to that is absolutely not. We need our students on campus, but you know, I do think this will be a transition for higher education. And, you know, if you're not focused on, you know, transformational ideas and radical thinking, you very much could become a have-not, especially for those institutions and schools that are less resourced and relying less and less on state-supported funds.
Do you anticipate, I think we've already seen some of this, Michael, but you've got a small team and you spend as much time thinking, I know you spend as much time thinking about being in the supervisory role as you do in the, you know, on the ground, boots on the ground in front of the donor. Do you think we're going to see more transition in the next, say, 12, 24 months between fundraisers moving to institutions that COVID has now sort of enlightened them on how poorly designed some of these fundraising operations really are? I've had a couple of guests on here in the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks where I'm listening to them and they seem to have sort of seen some things within the organizations. They're not very forthright about the fact that they're thinking about leaving, but they seem to be, and perhaps this is before I hit the record button with some of them or afterwards, but they seem to be sort of aware that maybe maybe the organization I'm working for was just not as prepared for something like this. And maybe some of the advice that we've historically been given or that we keep being given is not really it's not really up to par with the sort of the current reality. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think any institution that seemed to roll out and have the answers to this, you know, a couple weeks after
24 hours late, right?
24 hours later, we're jumping the gun. Yeah. I talked with my team. You talked about supervising and managing. My philosophy right there. I don't like the word management or managing. I see myself as a coach, and I think it's horizontal leadership.
Yeah.
I like to flip that org chart upside down.
Yeah.
They make me look good, and I try to empower them, and I think that increases productivity. But we talk about health and well-being all the time on my team. You know, step away. You know, take the afternoon off. Take a day off. Read. You know, we don't have the answers to this, and if your institution made it seem like they had all the answers, I would be be concerned. I think there needs to be I think this is growth for everyone, you know, from leadership down. And I will say I think NC State did a really good job and does a really good job of making sure to acknowledge health and well-being and that they don't have all the answers. And, you know, we're getting ready to come out of a campaign, and I think what gave us an advantage is we essentially had 24 months left in our Think and Do the Extraordinary campaign. So much of the work had been done, you know, on the waning years of this campaign, to where it's enabled us to kind of keep having success. Our foundation had its best year in 2020.
Yeah.
In the COVID, we're about to eclipse our totals from last year midway through this fiscal year. And I think that's because we've developed those relationships authentically and moved them in the right way. And now they have trust and they want to support us when they know there's a sense of urgency. And it's been a great opportunity for us. And so I don't know if I answered your question, but I would say,
yeah. So you were talking about Bill Crouch. I know Bill talks a lot about social intelligence and our emotional intelligence, just something which is largely along the same line of social intelligence. It's your ability to sort of see some of the more qualitative, sort of softer indicators of what it means to be sort of in this sort of social space. And I know you probably got involved in that conversation when you talked to Jennifer. Jennifer and I talk a lot about this. And you and I have enjoyed this conversation. Do you think that idea that you were speaking on a few minutes ago about having answers, you know, when you talk about emotional intelligence, when you talk about work that is highly, highly engaging work where you're interacting with other human beings, having the answers really isn't what this is about. I mean, we're not technicians. We don't want to be master technicians who basically are tinkering around in the, you know, engine room of a large, you know, engine, or tinkering around under the hood in my, you know, minivan or something. We're talking about human beings, and maybe having answers is perhaps where we're going to come, is perhaps where fundraising is going to find itself, Michael, on the other side of COVID-19, whenever that sort of other side is perhaps part of the silver lining going to be that maybe we feel like we don't always have to have, And let me offer this. So I was watching Fauci's interview last night. So folks, for this, for those of you who are not following sort of the, so we're 2 days after the inauguration, and Fauci, Dr. Fauci's up on the, doing a press conference yesterday, and he doesn't have, you know, former President Bush sort of lingering over his shoulders, trying to control everything that he says. And one of the things that Fauci said that I don't know that we've heard him say, you know, last year when he was doing these press conferences, is that if he doesn't have answers to the problems, if he doesn't have an answer, now President Biden has basically said, you don't answer that question. If you don't have an answer, you don't have to give one. And I think we've been so, you know, inundated in our space, and certainly in the much more macro level sort of our workplace and our society, that we always have to have answers. We're talking about a human endeavor here, and there's not always answers to things. Am I right?
You're right. You're 100% right. I remember when I was an intern for the Wolfpack Club in 2000, the first thing we were instructed was that if we're on the phone with athletic supporters that are calling about parking and ticketing questions, where they sit, how much they give, what many points they get, if you don't know the answer, you say, I don't know, we'll get back to you. You can't BS your way through this stuff. And we got to think differently. We don't have to always think the same way. I think to another one of your points on the emotional intelligence with Bill. I've seen dozens and dozens of resumes of people that look similar on paper.
Yeah.
People ask me, how do you hire? What are you looking for?
Yeah.
Resumes are going to look the same. I want to know how those individuals communicate on the phone interview and how they present themselves and communicate in a face-to-face interview.
Yeah.
I made a radical calculated risk hire recently. I'm not going to say this was this individual has a lot of wisdom based on her age. I'm not going to say her age, but let's just say she's got great wisdom.
Yeah.
And was an entrepreneur. She had her own, television show on PBS for a number of years.
Wow.
She is a great writer, and she connects with people so well. What did she not have? Jason, she didn't have a lengthy career in fundraising.
Right.
Brought her in. I wanted to bring her in. I had gotten to know her. And if you look at the college, Wilson College of Textiles, I talked with a number of alumni, let's say, that graduated in the 60s, early 70s, I would say 50% of them are going to share with me that they were discriminated against in some form, you know, while at the college or in that industry. And you can imagine this has been a blue collar, predominantly dominated by, you know, Caucasian males over the years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not the person to be in front of that.
South of the Mason Dixon and all that that comes with that. So,
Absolutely. And look at me. I'm probably not the best person to engage in that, you know, conversation and understand it the way that they felt it.
Yeah.
So I made this hire and I said, this is what I want you to do for me. Cause there's a fluency there and there's inclination, but there's some bitterness and but they still love the institution.
Yeah.
And she's been in front of that audience and she's now saying, but now we have 70% female students and we have more female faculty than we have male, and it's changed and there's inclusion. And let me tell you, she has no fundraising experience and has raised more money than, or is on the path to raising more money in a very short period of time during a pandemic than others on our team. One lady called, didn't know her, called her up from Connecticut, said, I want to do a scholarship. It was thrown at her. No conversations. And my teammate said, well, what made you call me? And she said, well, I looked at your website and I wanted to call someone that I thought was going to be mature and wise. And you know, they look the same in terms of their demographics, Jason. And then the other example I would give you is that she just has she's extremely successful in connecting with people because she's very authentic. Yeah. I can teach the fundraising. I can teach the distributions on endowments. I can teach the different gift vehicles. But sometimes she gets in front of herself, and I'm like, you don't know all the answers. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. You know, let me help you with that. And then you learn from me as you learn more of the technical side of it.
Yeah, you're encouraging her to be a human being, which first and foremost, I think, is sometimes what we forget. But I think I have talked about this book. It's a profound book. I'm linking it in all my show notes for the last couple of weeks. Michael, I read a book recently by a guy named David Epstein called Range. And in that book, he talks about what he calls the cult of early specialization. And some of this thinking that I'm sharing with you here as it relates to this book, this is certainly relates to the scenario with your new employee. Fundraising, in my mind, has this bad habit of allowing people to specialize early in their careers in what I call these arm's length tactics, galas, golf tournaments, you know, highly automated stuff, lots of direct response, special event planning. When you look at all those sort of tactics, they tend to be those online giving, Giving Tuesdays of that sort. All of these things tend to keep us at an arm's length with those donors, and consequently, it doesn't usually yield the most meaningful gifts. But on the professional side, when we think about our own professional development, Epstein would say that it's basically you're guilty of what he would call early specialization. Too early in your fundraising career, you're specializing in an area that long term is not going to give you, professionally speaking, and certainly not you, the organization you're working for, the margins that ultimately we're looking for in fundraising. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And fortunately, I was around some pretty good, smart people. And I was early in my career doing auctions down in Greenville for athletics. You know, I think we probably spent 6 months collecting items and just tons of it, right. Tons of time.
Right, sure.
Make $80,000. This guy comes down and visits with us, and he said, well, I'd like to think, you know, with an effective conversation, you could probably raise $80,000 in a couple visits. Is it really worth the time that you're putting into it?
Right.
And I think events should be really more centered around your stewardship elements.
Yeah.
Day of givens are great. NC State's had great success. And it's a tactic for us. You know, it's just an opportunity to use that as a strategy for certain major gift conversations. But truly what I think day of giving is intended for is donor acquisition, getting people in the door.
Yeah.
And this year our theme is probably a bit different than how many people have thought about it. But when we came back from the holiday break, I said, you know, our day of giving theme is going to be, it's going to be celebrating. It's going to be celebrating this campaign. This is the last day of giving in our campaign. And I want this to be about gratitude and celebrating the impact our donors have had on our college, and running some short clips with the dean, some students, some donors about why they've been inspired to support and give, what the impact has been. And, you know, the old saying is everybody likes a winner, and hopefully that will inspire those that have never given to maybe, you know, make that first gift. But yeah, I just don't, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time on those special events that are going to raise you $20,000. Go build a meaningful relationship and get that $25,000 from that one individual when you can make a great case support for advancing your mission.
You know, going back to that, your new employee and what you're observing sort of in her work and what we'll call this more diversified pool of donors. I was talking to a gentleman from the Children's Defense Fund, their chief advancement officer, earlier this week. And he was telling me that in the midst of COVID, they doubled down on what was their new acquisition strategies they've been working on for the last several years. And one of the things he talked about was just how he said, Jason, the pool of donors that are coming through this new acquisition program that's really taken off, it's had some remarkable results, apparently, is a much more diverse, there's far more women in this particular pool of donors than he has in his 30 years historically seen in these new acquisition pools of, you know, of new donors. And sort of what occurs to me as you're describing the experiences that you're having with this new member of your team is sort of what we've experienced here in our local community. So we're here in central Pennsylvania, and for the last, you know, half century, we've had this, what I call this lucky list of 10 or 12 old wealthy white guys who, for the most part, for the last decade, since about the time of the 2008 recession, and since then and up until now, a number of these guys are actually deceased now. But they've sort of been giving this message that we're sort of tapped out, you know, tapped out probably financially, but more so probably just emotionally. They're emotionally tapped out. They just can't take on, they don't want to take on any more commitments to any additional organizations, which is to say they're at that time of life, you know, it's an old white guy, old wealthy white guy who's basically saying, you know, I've accumulated all the wealth that I'm going to. I've decided who I'm going to give to for the remainder of my, you know, I'm 75 years old. I'm going to give to these organizations. They're tapped out. And so I think, am I right when I sort of assume that some of the opportunity, some of the, what has perhaps surprised you and your colleague there in this new scenario is it's a refreshment of what it is we're doing. It's bringing new life into the system, and it's a diverse pool of donors, like my colleague, like our colleague at the Children's Defense Fund. Am I right?
You're right. I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit on you. You're right and you're wrong. I don't think you don't want to give up on that generation. And at the same time, yes, there's a new opportunity for the younger generation. So let me break that down, give you an example on both sides.
Sure.
I've always wondered why we don't have more diversity gift officers at universities.
Yeah.
Again, let's think about our audience. We had a lot of social injustice and a lot of, you know, police brutality and issues amongst this COVID thing. And it was raw, and it was hard for a lot of people to see. So we, again, going back to our town halls, we decided we were going to have a Black alumni cultural town hall. And it was great. I didn't participate in that. One of my colleagues who's on our team, Tasia Priest, co-moderated that with one of our directors in student services, Delicia Hinton. And they just were able to have an open conversation. And, you know, our core values at the Wilson College of Textiles include compassion and inclusivity. And this was really the first time they kind of heard that message from us. And so we took this opportunity because millennials, again, I'm sure, Jason, you know this better than I do in looking at research and data. They're more focused on smaller gifts with, you know, they're with specific impact, more restricted giving.
Sure.
So universities got to understand the minority population hasn't been able to accumulate generational wealth like the white privileged families have over the years. They don't have that same capacity. So we had to, but they're extremely valuable and important and need to be equally represented amongst a diverse alumni base. So we have to make sure that, you know, we see them through a different lens in terms of philanthropy. So we decided we were going to launch a diversity and inclusion fund on our day given last year because of everything that was going on, because of our town halls. We had a board member start that fund off with $10,000. And at the end of day given, we had more than $30,000 raised with an alumni population that had never given to us that were inspired. And those are the opportunities, I think, that we can create. Now, on the other issue, an example of why you shouldn't necessarily give up on those that are tapped out or you've gone to the well too many times is, have you invested in making that time to have that relationship? Has the right case for support or the right interest of theirs been presented? A gentleman comes to mind when I first came here, a good friend of mine at Clemson who knew this family said, hey, you need to go see so-and-so up in Martinsville. He's ran a textile business for 30 years and he's got a lot of money and he's very philanthropic. I looked at the call notes. Oh my goodness. What a debacle. I mean, NC State over the years had been going up and seeing him about all sorts of opportunities and priorities that had nothing to do with his giving trends at the university. So they're pitching things that he has no interest in. So I call him up. I've made my last gift. I made my last gift to NC State, Michael. I've made my last gift. No need to come see me. I was like, I respect that. I'll send you some literature and if I can ever do anything for you, let me know. Fast forward a couple months later, I had a board member say, you need to go meet so-and-so up in Martinsville, Virginia. And I said, well, you know, turns out, you know, ironically, I tried and he doesn't know me and doesn't want me to come up. He's making assumptions. He says, I know someone that knows him well. Come have lunch with me in Pinehurst. Went and I had lunch with my board member and another great volunteer connector. He opened the door for me very effectively. And I promised I'm not going to go up there and ask this guy for any money. I just want to go get to know him and hear his story. I mean, he's a giant in our college. He's done amazing things with his career. We need to know that. So my friend in Martinsville agreed for me to come up. I went up. He was very guarded, very defensive. You know, I had to really squeeze a lot to get him to give much. But at the end of the conversation and after he shared with me his story and his family story and his company, I said, Dudley, that's amazing. I'd love for us to do a story about you and your father and your company. You mean so much to our college. You've done so much for us. And he said, Michael, I really haven't done anything. And I said, it's not about giving. It's not all about giving. It's about the success that you've had from your education and, you know, the company that you ran. I mean, it's amazing. We wrote a story. So, he agreed to that. He agreed to that. I spent probably 3 hours of my life working with the writer over six months to get this right. He loved the story. He said, Michael, come see me. I want to talk about the foundation. I drove up to see him. His guard was down. How was your drive? What a beautiful day for a drive. The weather is gorgeous. Have a seat. Michael, I'm going to tell you what I want to do. I'm going to give you $1 million today. This was a guy that told me a few months earlier he had made his last gift to NC State.
But that sounds like a guy. I think a lot of us have interacted with that particular donor. I think when I think about these 12 old white guys that I referred to here in our community here, I'm thinking about their emotion, the emotional sort of burden that oftentimes comes with. You sometimes hear this. They're sort of exhausted. I mean, we in our space talk about donor fatigue and that sort of stuff. And I think there's a place where I think the donor that you're describing. There was something you said earlier as you were describing that sort of narrative. There was something in there that sort of suggests that it's not about the resources they have or they don't have. It's that they do they have the margin at 70 years old or however these individuals are and whoever they happen to be, do they have the margin for which to add yet another charitable organization to their sort of their list? We have a family here in our community. You know, very affluent, old steel mill type, steel mill type money. You know, they fit the profile of the people that are, you know, 75, 80 plus years old today that are giving wealth. They fit that historical profile that all of us would sort of expect them to. But I got to tell you, every time I've interacted with them over the last 10 years, they're just exhausted with the work of having these relationships. And I guess what I'm getting at with this new colleague of yours and what I think is going to happen in philanthropy is we're going to start, and maybe this is some of the benefit of the way that we're sort of finding ourselves sort of in this place in history with COVID and stuff, is we're sort of all our systems and our processes in some ways have all been put on pause in some ways. And so when we can sort of all climb out of our caves again here in perhaps the next 12 months, we can turn we can turn our processes back on. There might be more new life in it. You know, I'm thinking about that individual on your team that you're describing, and I'm thinking about her getting on the road here in 12 months, and it might be some pretty invigorating work. The gifts, perhaps, yeah, I get the economics of it, that those people, that the general sort of wealth that may be accumulated in that, the average size of the asset base in that particular portfolio may not be as significant. But it sure as hell is going to be an invigorating list of stories, is it not?
I think you're right. I mean, I'm gonna
relish if I'm in your shoes and I'm the boss. I'm going to relish the stories that they're going to come. You know, you remember the story, I've talked about it a couple of times here on the podcast, the story Smith at the Morehouse College gift, you know, he gave like $40 million to basically wipe out the all the student loan debt and all the balances for the graduating class at Morehouse here about 2 or 3 years ago. And $40 million for most institutions that are listening is an extraordinary gift. And compared to some like McKinsey's gift, you know, McKinsey Scott's gift right before Christmas, it's not even, you know, scratching the surface of that one. But the extraordinary story that sort of plays out in that is, I think, what's so exciting. You know what I mean?
100%. And, you know, I'm hedging my bets that because of the way we've approached this pandemic with our team, with these town halls and these check-ins,
yeah,
we're going to reap the benefit of that when we're able to get out and travel. And,
yeah.
I think I would rather us take that approach than be trying to create gift conversations with discovery prospects via phone or screen. This is where you have to be patient. You have to invest the time and do it right. And, you know, to your point about the gentlemen that have donor fatigue, you're right. And this is a question I love to ask. I mean, these are the people that get approached by multiple organizations, by new development professionals every year. And, you know, have you ever thought to ask that affluent alum, hey, you see a lot of Michael Wards come into your office. Where do we miss the mark and who gets it right? I mean, like, how do affluent donors want to be engaged and approached from development professionals at multiple nonprofit organizations? You'd be very surprised. They love to answer that question and they don't get it asked enough, but you got to remember that you're going in and seeing that guy that 30 other organizations are competing with, and how do you prepare yourself to stand out?
You know, it's funny. The thing is, you think back about what we were talking about 10, 15 minutes ago. If you think you have all the answers, if you think fundraising is a science, and if you think basically there's three or four steps, it's very formulaic. If you think there's sort of an algorithm to getting to $100,000 gift, you don't really generally permit yourself to ask that question. I mean, isn't that sort of the, again, I'm not going to name names, but there's a school that was recently interviewed. You know, it was a gentleman that was in a role like yours at a school out west, and he's interviewed on another podcast. And I'm listening to him recently, and he's got this very he makes this comment about how he wants to totally take the gut. This is the expression he made. He said, "I want to totally take the gut out of my fundraisers. I don't want them." He's basically he's saying, "I don't want to take any of that sort of discernment out of the decision-making process for my donors. I want to basically give them a roadmap. I want them to follow it to the T, and come back with the check." And I thought, man, if you haven't been out in the field long enough good luck.
Good luck, man. Jason, let me know how that works out. Right.
I mean, I remember early in my major gift career, I had done a meeting the day before that morning, and I was in New Orleans, actually, and I'm driving up to Shreveport, Louisiana. And, you know, I've got this storm. All of a sudden, in the middle of the day, this storm just, you know, plummets down on my day. And I get this phone call. I'm working off, you know, this is 10, 15 years ago, I think it was. And I'm working off this old cell phone. And the woman I'm driving up to Shreveport to meet is canceling my meeting. You just cannot turn these things into an algorithm. And it was in that moment. It was in that very moment when I realized, and I've repeated this simple story numerous times, you can't predict that stuff. I couldn't predict the frustration of that storm that was slowing me down. And I couldn't predict the idea that woman was going to call me up an hour before the meeting and say, "Look, I can't meet with you." And she didn't care that I had bought plane tickets and stuff and arranged this trip for a week or 2 weeks or whatever. You cannot predict that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, the way I would try to answer that and how I've come to how I've been able to, make sense, logically make sense out of this in my own mind is science is great. You know, research is great.
Yes.
You know, certain processes. You can have someone on paper that's worth $20 million. But if you can't connect with an individual, a human, a human condition, and have, an intelligent, authentic conversation, it doesn't matter how wealthy they are. And then the other thing I would say to that is some of your most affluent alums look so poor on paper.
Yeah. The money's somewhere else and you're never going to find it on a well screen.
My friend, his birthday is today. Happy birthday, Fred Wilson. Named the College of Textiles for $28 million. Jason, how much money? He's in his 80s.
Yeah.
Love for you to take a guess at how much his lifetime giving was up to that point for Wilson College or NC State, University.
Yeah, probably not anywhere close. Nothing of any significance to signal that sort of opportunity is my guess.
Yeah, $68. And he went, his grandson had exponentially given more money, having graduated 6 months earlier than his grandfather.
Yeah, exactly.
Science has been telling us for years this man was wealthy. We've been trying for years to get connected with him, but it was the approach and connecting the family who had the most engagement with the university who trusted us to kind of learn and develop a loving and meaningful relationship with everyone in that family. It's crazy. It's not rocket science. We talk about that. Keep it simple. Be authentic.
Yeah, we realized when I was at the Epilepsy Foundation in D.C., Danielle and I realized, so we had, the Epilepsy Foundation at the time had 70,000 names in their database. 9 times out of 10, the family that was giving to the foundation had somebody, either they themselves or they had a family member, a loved one that was affected by a seizure disorder. And, some of the file, that very large database, some of that file had opportunity in it in terms of affluence and wealth, and a large significant part of it didn't. And we do these well screens, and I'm an advocate for using those tools. But one of the things that we realized is those tools do us very little if you can't get that initial meeting. And so what we ended up doing for those first 6 months of my job, we were creating these reports and we were getting Eric, our president, out on the road and so forth. But it wasn't too long in there, and I was learning major gift work, and Danielle, my senior director, was learning major gift work. And we realized that putting all that data into the process that early in the process, it was the wrong place when data mattered. Because if you couldn't get what the data was actually doing, knowing that this, for example, I'm thinking about a family in Pittsburgh that if I name their name, everybody know who they were. So getting into that family in Pittsburgh, for example, knowing what sort of wealth was there was really just going to slow down and almost conjure up fear and anxiety and intimidate me, who just needs to pick up the phone and have the confidence to ask for a meeting.
And so
what we needed, what we realized is we came to the place where we said, okay, Jason's always going to have 100 names in his portfolio. He schedules the meeting with a minimum amount of information, largely based on a historical willingness to give, right? So if they're a current donor, they've given at a particular level, ask for the meeting and be willing to go to Pittsburgh, for example. And then it was at that point when that data, like, for instance, do some well screening to find out what other, how many shares of Alcoa do they own or whatever. All of that mattered subsequent to actually them demonstrating that, yeah, we'll take the meeting. Yeah, we'll have a meaningful conversation with you. And yeah, you actually give a damn about what you're doing. Because if they don't, it's like what you just said. It doesn't matter how much wealth they've got.
Yeah, I tell my team, and I believe this, Jason, who do you think our best researchers are? Us as individuals, right? So we don't need to request a bunch of research before we even know whether or not there's inclination to meet. And so I don't like doing research on prospects until we've had a meeting.
Yeah.
We've been able to ask questions and there's an opportunity. I mean, what good is it going to do to have your research team invest that time with someone that might not ever meet with you? Cause it does take a lot of time. And I think we got to be more thoughtful and it's quality, not quantity with our approach. So,
well, Michael, I have had your attention for more than 45 minutes, and we lose our listeners right now on the podcast. It could just be you and me here when we're broadcasting, and everybody might have given up on this conversation. But where do you think we're going to be? Let's sort of wrap this up on the thought. Where do you think we're going to be 12 months from now? Are we going to have a large cohort of sort of this? Are we going to have new cohorts of donors, new cohorts of development officers, and maybe a more enlightened understanding of how all this works? Or are we going to still be sort of trudging through the trenches of sort of this old school formulaic sort of machine metaphor? How many different ways can we sort of characterize this thing as an old machine? Where do you think we're going to be in 12 months?
I hope it's more of the previous statement that we really think radically different, that I think our donors are going to become more sophisticated with their giving.
Yeah.
Every time you have something like this happen, it might be more focused on healthcare right now. There may be more focus on community engagement. We have to be, I talk about shared leadership all the time and empowering my team and conscious leadership. We need to empower our teams to go about their work in a meaningful way, be very strategic. I don't mean strategic by laying out 20 steps. I mean strategic by personalizing and really thinking about each individual you're working with, and getting our messaging right. So I hope I'm on the front side of that leadership. I think there's great opportunities to further a lot of organizations' missions, and it's noble work.
Good deal, Michael. Michael, you're always welcome back. It's certainly been a pleasure to develop the friendship. I look forward to being at across a real lunch table or coffee shop. In the meantime, we'll continue to utilize platforms like this. If there's someone else who's interested in reaching out to you, having a conversation, perhaps learning more about what you're doing, maybe learning more about NC State, something of that sort, how would you suggest that they do that?
Please visit me on LinkedIn. Shoot me a message. I got an email at NC State, mtward@ncsu.edu. And I'd love to connect you, particularly those young fundraisers that are coming along and are probably, questioning, is this a noble or is this a worthy career? Let's talk. I'd love to. And for your loyal listener base, thank you so much. Big shout out to Jennifer Harris on the West Coast. Love her to death. She's a great writer. And Jason, I'm so thankful for you and what you do for the profession. And I hope we can continue this conversation.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.